We recorded this episode of The Rational Educator in November of 2021, shortly after a series of stunning election results in which education became a major political topic, and significantly, not in the traditional way in which education is typically used, as empty platitudes that politicians employ to show the electorate how much they care about the children. No, in this election, parents expressed concern about the content of education, that the curricula itself, driven by the hot-button issue of critical race theory, strayed away from the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and was based entirely on anti-Western, anti-American propaganda. So in this episode, we talk about political solutions. Can they actually work and create meaningful change, or is there something deeper going on that's impervious to popular uprisings? If you like what we're doing here at The Rational Educator, check out our website, rationaleducator.com. On the homepage, you'll find the very latest news in the world of education. Sign up for our email list by going to the bottom of the homepage and clicking on the sign up button. And let us know what you think. Email us at info@rationaleducator.com. Here's the episode. Well, we here at the Rational Educator podcast like to argue for education being the most important aspect of society that drives a culture. So it would seem that if you wanted to change the culture, you'd want to take over education, but it's not really as simple as that. So let's throw it off to Deanna and ask, what are some of the unintended consequences of pursuing a political solution to education?
Well, it is definitely a heated argument going on across the country. This is being recorded in November of 2021, and there was just an election, and education really became the forefront of a lot of those polls that, elections and local elections and school board elections. And so as of the summer of 2021, there were 28 states that were looking into some sort of legislation to keep schools from being allowed to teach anything about a special racial or ethnic groups and giving sort of bias, which critical race theory falls under that. Interestingly enough, there are about 12 or 13 states that are trying to pass legislation to make sure those topics are being taught. And so you can kind of guess which falls on what end of the political spectrum. And so now what we have, and the founding fathers left education to the states purposefully. And so it is a state issue, but is it a political issue? Should legislation be passed? For instance, there was a bill that was passed in Texas. It's House Bill number 3979. And it states, and I'll just paraphrase because it's, legalese here written in this bill, but it basically states that if you're going to teach anything in history, you have to make sure that you teach different viewpoints of that same event. This is confusing for teachers because let's take World War II and the Holocaust, for example. That means that if you're teaching about the Holocaust, that you also have to bring in Holocaust deniers. And do we want that viewpoint that are denying that this atrocity actually happened to be taught to kids? And so once you start passing legislation, it is a slippery slope, and it's left, a lot of legislation is left up to interpretation. And there are so many unintended consequences. And this is just one example. Another thing is that we here at Rational Educator are morally, philosophically, completely opposed to critical race theory because it is Marxism. But is passing legislation banning that the right action? And so I've been really following this, particularly over the last few weeks, and I've seen some interesting arguments. And I would love for Dr. Andy to comment on some of these too. For instance, there was one it was a kind of a question and answer session, but basically there was a probably early 20s, maybe late teens, college age kid came up to the microphone and asked the speaker, who was talking about banning critical race theory and why it was important, and asked, Do you believe in the First Amendment? And the speaker said yes. And then the speaker said, do you believe that you should ban critical race theory? Isn't that free speech? Ban teaching that in schools. And the speaker came back and said, well, do you want eugenics taught in schools? But the thing is that eugenics isn't taught in schools anymore. Going back to 1850s, Herbert Spencer was really pushing that idea. It's not a modern idea that we really see pushed in schools. And so I'm not sure that was really, it's an interesting argument and it kind of shut down the conversation, but is that the right argument? So it's a very convoluted world that we're living in terms of kids are being indoctrinated into Marxist ideology, bottom line, when critical race theory is taught. Is that right? Is school a place to indoctrinate children, or should they just be learning how to read, how to write, how to do arithmetic, and not be given these sort of political ideas or these philosophical or moral or amoral, whatever your stand are those things should be introduced to the classroom? And so critical race theory right now is often tied into, well, we need to teach about slavery in the past that happened in America and not sort of sugarcoat it or just erase it. And absolutely, history is history. There is objective truth. But it's getting really kind of squished into this postmodern thought. And that is the problem. And I think a big problem is that all of the teachers are coming out of teachers' colleges and they all think alike. And so the legislation is like, we've got to stop these people because it is an echo chamber. So,
I want to set the table a little bit before we bring Andy into this. So what you're describing here is a situation in which we have an omnipresent worldview that originated in the colleges, and the graduates of those colleges are now in education, setting policy and teaching to the kids. So it's a philosophy and a worldview that at least we here in this conversation think is monstrous and propaganda and abusive, but what is the proper solution to this? Are we looking for a political solution in which we ban the teaching of these harmful things, or is there some other way to approach this? So, Andy, what do you have to say about that?
Oh God, it's a mess. But there's a whole bunch of things to be said. First of all, the overwhelming problem with government schools is that it's an agency of coercion. It's an agency of force. Notice the public school, government schools, public schools is the euphemism. They get money by taxation, that is by force, and they get victims, students, by compulsory education laws. What is it, something like 88 to 90% of American school kids, 5 to 17, go to the government schools. In some cases, the parents maybe can't afford to send them to a private school. So they have no financial incentive to excel. They get money and customers, if we can call family and the kids their customers, by coercion. So they have that's one bottom line problem with the public schools. Related to that, so the government runs the schools. Who runs? The government sets up the schools. Who runs? Who makes the decision regarding content, teaching methods, and things like that? Well, they need an agency to do it. Call it the Bureau of Education. Well, who controls the bureau? In a dictatorship, the state does, and they, and under the communists or the national socialists or any dictatorship, the state does, and they use it to ram propaganda down the throats of the kids. In a mixed economy like ours, which is partly free and partly government controlled, you have different pressure groups vying to control the bureau and ram their ideas of education down the throats of the kids. 100 years ago, evolution was your perfect example. you know, the super religious people banned it in a number of states from, you know, 1920s, and evolution couldn't be taught legally in public high school biology courses for 40 years until it was overturned by Supreme Court ruling in the late 1960s. Today, you know, it's not the fundamentalists or the religionists who so much control the Bureau of Education or the Department of Education. It's leftists, and you know, they ram leftist propaganda down the kids' throats. Pernicious, human caused warming, America is systemically racist, and white people are all racist. Capitalism's evil, socialism is, or even communism is much better. So you have this, the whole system is based on force. And so you get these bitter wars over who's going to control the Bureau or the Department of Education, what content's going to be taught, what method, we use, for instance, the people who run, you know, what did Arthur Bester call it? The interlocking directorate. You know, E.D. Hirsch called it an impregnable fortress. The people who run the school system, for instance, for a long time have militated against phonics in the teaching of reading. Parents generally want phonics, but, you know, those who run the education system generally don't want phonics. So it's this endless fighting that goes on, political pressure. Now, the best thing to do is just be to ban the whole thing, abolish the system and, you know, privatize education. Because if we, you know, notice, if we as supporters of freedom and education and privatized education, if we support the government and state government in Texas, ban critical race theory, or in Florida, we are conceding the claim that, well, the government should be making these kinds of decisions, which is a, you know, very bad concession to make. But in the present mixed economy circumstances, somebody's going to control the Bureau and ram, you know, by force, forcibly ram their point of view down the throats of the kids. And so, yeah, under this system, I think we need to do everything we can, including legally and politically, to make the government schools as less bad as we possibly can, while all the time militating towards abolition, as our good friend Brad Thompson calls it, abolition of the government schools and, you know, the privatization of the school system. In this system, the mixed economy system of pressure group warfare, the only alternative to getting involved at the political level is letting the left dictate everything that's taught in the schools and the methods that the schools use.
So there is really no objection to showing up at your school board meetings and agitating for change. The problem with trying to pursue a political solution, or more aptly, trying to pursue a solution that lies in the hands of politicians, is that even if you win victory, what happens when there's a regime change? So we know that in the last administration, we had a banning of critical race theory in the federal government, but the regime changed and those bans were lifted. So the political or resting your answers in the hands of politicians strategy is something that is temporary at best, changing with whatever the political fashion is. So our long-term solution has to be something else. And even while we're able to fight the political battle at present, because we have to do something, but what's really the long-term solution here?
I think ultimately the long-term solution would be to just pull kids out of the government schools and homeschool. I mean, I'm a homeschool advocate for this reason, is that I think parents are the best equipped to teach their kids. And we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but I cannot say it enough that one way to really make change in what's happening is to pull your kids out. And by doing that, then the schools don't get paid for the headcount that your kids would contribute to. Now, that is a big commitment. That is a big leap. That is a big adjustment. And some families just can't do it or don't want to do it. Private school is another option. Charter schools, you know, there are, you know, some of these other options, but the one thing to keep in mind, what parents really need to do if they're looking at some of these alternatives, is to realize and to really do the homework and the due diligence that these other types of schools still report to the Department of Ed when it comes to, you know, at the end of the day, through accreditation. If you're going to put your kids in a charter school or in a private school, and it is an accredited school, which most people would want their kids to go there because then colleges or whatever, that is that, you know, this school has passed muster, but that passing muster is still passing muster by what the Department of Ed dictates is what should be done. And this is all ends up being political. Even school boards are political. For a lot of people, getting elected as someone on the school board is a stepping stone to a higher political office someday. And it's one of those sort of gateway entry points into politics. And so the school boards can be a very politicized entity. And you may not think it, you may just think that, you know, these are moms or dads or community members that just want to look out for kids, but it's not everyone has that sort of good intention. And
we found that out in the recent elections too. We discovered that many of what you might think would be the most hotly contested elections in the heartland, the Midwest, we discovered that many of those school board elections were cakewalks for candidates that were supported by the teachers unions. And there really wasn't as much of a fight that we thought there was going to be. Now, in some of the highly publicized races, say in Virginia, there were more of a grassroots opposition to the existing order. But again, this comes back to our original thought when we entered this podcast. These are some of the downfalls of pursuing political action, political solutions to problems of education. So then what you suggested that taking your kids out of schools is one great way to approach this problem. Andy, in our pre-show, you mentioned that there were some other intermediate steps that might help remove the funding mechanisms of these schools.
Right. And I think we need to fight on all fronts, because one, education is the foundation of everything in that's good in the call or bad. Education is the foundation. And two, it's controlled by people I consider irrational monsters today. So one thing we could do on the political front is try, you know, legislate or advocate for tax credits. And that is, if parents, right now, a lot of parents cannot afford to pay twice for education, right? They're paying for the government schools by their property taxes, sometimes their income taxes, sometimes even the sales tax. And then they can't afford to send their kids to a private school. But if the parents, under tax credits, if they send their kids to private school, they get their tax money back that's taken from them, you know, to finance the government schools. They get that money back, which could help them afford to send their kid to a private school. So I think that's one intermediate step towards privatization of the current system. But like, I'm sorry, Joel, did you?
I was just going to add that I'm old enough to remember in the 80s when tuition tax credits were originally a platform upon which politicians could run on. I'm thinking mid 80s, Reagan era politics. And there was a great deal of discussion about it, but the champions of these proposals were laid flat by the argument that they would be taking resources away from a badly needed government agency in the public schools. You're basically arguing that you would take something of value away from the people that need it the most in the public school system. And they were just flattened. They were not able to pursue this. Now, I remember also that that argument morphed into a similar tack. So they, the champions of the tuition tax credits proposals, moved on and tried to agitate for vouchers. Mm-hmm. So direct payments instead of tuition tax credits, thinking that, okay, well, if your argument is that tuition tax credits would take away from the schools, meaning the public schools, well, why don't we just do vouchers instead? And of course, they were also destroyed on a the same kind of moral level, because the argument is that, oh, well, now you'd just be giving money to people who are wealthy and don't deserve it. So these arguments have been tried before and defeated. What say you, Andy, to how you might counter that argument?
It's funny. I mean, how you counter it? You take the bull by the horns is how you counter it. And you say resources should be taken away from these rotten institutions. The morally upright thing to do. What did Voltaire used to sign his letters? Destroy the infamous thing, right? He was talking about the church. But, you know, today we can say that about the government schools. Destroy the infamous thing by any peaceful means possible. So the more money we take away and more resources we take away from this hideous institution, the better. It's a step towards privatizing the educational system. And most parents overwhelmingly value academic education and phonics to teach reading much more than the government bureaucrats do. So the more we privatize education, the more we're going to see literacy, you know, and mastery of academic subjects go up in this country. So it's a good thing, is what is that way I would counter it. It's a good thing to take resources away from this, because notice the corruption and the perversity of the current system. The more the government schools fail, generally or often, the more money they get. Oh, we need more resources. The schools are horrible. We need more resources. They have no economic incentive to achieve. To excel, as I already said, and so we need to take the resources away from them and give it to the schools that do have an economic incentive to excel. So that's I'll tell these government school advocates to bring that argument on, because I'm gonna crush it. Man, this is a monstrous institution that doesn't deserve any resources. They should be stripped of all resources. But anyway, that just gets me agitated.
But that's so that the thing is that the problem with and the failure of those past proposals wasn't the proposals. It was the moral strength of its supposed champions. They made the proposals, but then cowered at accusations that they were taking away from people that deserved it. So if anyone were to propose those ideas, again, they'd need to borrow a little bit of moral strength from you, Dr. Bernstein. But I'd also like to add one other thing.
Well, it's not moral strength, Joe. That's cowardice. They know the government schools are doing a horrible job. They need to stand up and have the backbone to tell the truth.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Yeah, I get it, Mr. Marquez. But one other practical point. If I get tax credits to send my kids to a private school, the money that's being taken away is the money that would go towards educating my kid. That's not resources taken away from those that theoretically are going to educate my neighbor's kids.
Well, that's okay. Ridiculous. Yeah, that's absolutely valid. And that was the origin of the tuition tax credits strategy to reforming education. That's entirely valid. However, the champions of that idea were basically destroyed because they accepted the Marxist premise behind it, that your tax resources, your property doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the community, the state, right, the society. Now, I do want to add one other thing, though, that the latest version of this, which seems to be getting a little bit of traction, is the idea, and this is proposed by advocates like Corey DeAngelis, who proposed that the funding for individual students should follow the student wherever they go. So whatever is earmarked for an individual student to participate in the public school system should travel with them. So if they decide to go to a public or to a private school, it should go with them. If they decide to be homeschooled, those resources should go with the student. So the framing of this is very interesting. The budget should go or should travel with the student, which is an interesting way of framing it. And it does seem to be getting a little bit of traction in the political world. What do you guys have to say about that?
So it's an interesting concept. And in a utopian society, it's perfect. So it costs $14,000 a year to educate Bobby at the public school. So we're going to give that $14,000 a year to the parent. But the problem is with the funding formula. And every state and even some, you know, districts, they all have, it's usually done on the state level, although there are some areas where there's a little kind of more control on the district level, maybe some in like in larger cities. But the funding formula isn't that clear cut, because the schools can get aid from the state, they can get aid from the federal government. So if you're a state and you've adopted Common Core that the federal government wanted you to adopt, you get money. If you are a low performing school, you can get money. If you do this, you can get extra money. So it's not solely taxes like property taxes or income tax or sales tax that is funding these students at these individuals. So what's happened, and it's gotten more and more confusing. I mean, just like any sort of tax code, like if you wanted to read the entire tax code, you wouldn't be able to do it in your lifetime. And it is so convoluted now that these ideas, and this is, you know, sort of what the union, and the union has so much power. It is just obscene how much power teachers unions have. They have full-time lobbyists. I taught in the largest community college district in the United States, probably in the world. And the amount of lobby and money that they had to lobby just that one district is obscene. And so this battle is a huge battle to fight. And they, the teachers and the unions, have a lot of power, and they have a lot of politicians in that power. And so this idea of, you know, it's great. I love the idea that the money follows the student, but it is so convoluted that you don't even know where the money comes from for each.
Well, one could argue that it was designed to be convoluted, or at least, if not designed, then it's at least an emergent property of a complex and corrupt system.
You know, and it's and there are so many things that are top down now. So for instance, Title IX, Department of Ed, and you now have to have Title IX administrators. You have to have DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion administrators, even in private schools. They are mandating it through accreditation. And so you have so much administration now that's top heavy, that it is so, the system is so broken and so messed up. The only, for me, the only solution is just to implode it and make it go away. But that's not an easy battle, which is why I'm a homeschool advocate, where I think every family should figure out a way, get together with other families and homeschool. That is the most impactful way to make change in the system.
Well, what do you think would be simpler then? I mean, you know, take your child out of the system, whether it's a public school or a private school where all the teachers and administrators have been trained at teachers' colleges. It seems like the simpler solution would just be to exit the system and let it fall in on itself. And on the individual level, for an individual parent and an individual family, that seems like the simplest solution.
I think it is. And it is really frightening, which is why I spend a lot of time researching and trying to find ways to help families make that transition. But really, the only way for this system to collapse is not through politics. It's, you know, even if a new president came in and his one main thing was to destroy the Department of Ed, it is not that easy, because theoretically, we aren't a dictatorship, right? One person can't do it. I'm still holding out.
So, Andy, maybe you can correct me on this, but didn't Ronald Reagan campaign on a promise to dismantle the Department of Energy or Education?
Yeah, he did. He did. Unfortunately,
how'd that work out for him?
Well, about as well as Trump trying to drain the swamp. You know, Reagan did some good things as president, without a doubt. He helped topple the Soviet Empire. He gets, you know, a lot of credit for that. But domestically, and I don't know how much effort he even put into it, or was he just defeated by the swamp monsters? Like Trump was. It's very difficult. Once you have this entrenched bureaucracy. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people, is very difficult to end it.
And people that have a lot of resources and power. So we're not talking about, you know, just like teachers wanting to keep their jobs. There are still some really good teachers out there. But unfortunately, they are embedded into a system where they cannot win. Right. And I think those teachers, like myself, are better off walking away.
Right. That's what I wanted to add to what you said before, Dr. D, about the ultimate solution, you know, homeschooling, homeschool co-ops, and then, you know, what they call micro schools and your small community schools, because I'm seeing in the news and on Facebook that there are across the country, a teacher here and a teacher there who's had it and, you know, and walks away. This is what Marva Collins did, you know, many years ago. And some of those teachers are willing or even happy to work with some of the parents who want to walk away and teach, open a small school, especially our friend Mike Gustafson in Massachusetts, who was a certified teacher, did teach elementary school in the public school system, and then walked away from it and started his own school, Atlas Academy. He told me it's easy having been a certified teacher. It's easier to get state approval to open your school than if you're not a certified teacher, if you're just a parent who wants to homeschool. So if you can find, and I think there are, like Dr. D said, Joel, I think there are, you know, good teachers who are disgruntled with the system, who might be willing to walk away and open, one parent, let's say you have four or five families, you know, maybe have five kids, and one parent could donate their basement, you know, or your rec room or something. You know, you can start a small community school with a certified teacher, elementary school teacher, you know, or what have you. There are different ways. Maybe this needs to start small. In fact, it's already started, as we've discussed. Homeschooling is becoming more and more popular. But you know, there are different ways that we could, you know, that we could perpetuate and propagate this. I look for the Marva Collins. Now, she was extraordinary. I don't know how many Marva Collins we're going to find, but like Dr. D said, there are still good teachers in the system who may be disgusted with it, like Marva Collins was, and be willing to walk away and work with a few parents and have a small community school.
Well, the tragedy of the current system is how it destroys the teachers who are the most independent and the most contrary to the existing order. Because in order to function within that world, and Deanna, maybe you can speak to this, you do have to lay low. You do kind of have to mind your P's and Q's. What was it like for you in that system?
One, it was miserable. I taught classes in the ancient world. I taught humanities full time, and I taught Western Civ and world history in the first half. And I was repeatedly asked why I wasn't including people of color in a class on ancient Greece and Rome. I taught,
Let's just tell them Socrates got a suntan. You know?
Exactly. Well, I told them that when we got to Rome, there were some former slaves of African descent in Rome who were freed and became poets, and we would read their poetry, but we're still in Greece, so we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, where they're getting that, though. I mean, getting college students who pick that up in high school and elementary school.
And that's the thing, is that it's really difficult. And so good teachers, I mean, I walked away before I would have been fired, and I was tenured, and I knew it would have been coming. I had already been, I was very active in state level academic senate, campus level academic senate, district level academic senate, and I was ostracized because I said the wrong things. And if you say the wrong things or ask the wrong questions, you get ostracized. So I was ostracized on those, you know, sort of levels where I was just trying to bring reason and thoughtfulness into an argument where resources are scarce. I also, you know, I taught Anthem by Ayn Rand, and I had to hide certain works. I taught Shakespeare, and, you know, those old dead white guys are the evil patriarchy. And so once they started making us publish our syllabi online, I knew it was just going to be a matter of time before I was going to have to be out of there anyway. So I left of my own accord. And I haven't looked back. I haven't regretted it a minute. You know, I can't shout from enough rooftops and want to help enough parents and hold their hand to tell them to homeschool. This is how it's done. This is, you can do it. Anyone can do it. So that's kind of my life's work now. It's still an education. It's just very different.
Now, let me jump in here for a second, Joel. I know we mentioned on the last show, Susan Wise Bauer's book, was it The Well-Trained Mind, that I've been going through, you know, for the book I'm writing on education. And it's really a lot of helpful information on how to, for homeschooling parents on how to do this. You know, it doesn't cover Mount Sinai. The homeschool parent could switch this or change that. But that's a really like an encyclopedic book. I think that's very effective for homeschool parents who aren't experienced teachers on how to teach their kids. So you said a number of times, Dr. D, there's a lot of resources out there for parents today who want homeschool.
And they're not all... The Well-Trained
Mind is one very good book.
Yeah, the Well-Trained Mind is one of those resources. And what I've discovered in interviewing many parents about their homeschooling experiences is that, you know, the Well-Trained Mind is one of the first comprehensive, unified, integrated systems that are out there. And a lot of parents gravitate to that work because they know that it feels like all the answers are there. And then they have their children go through the program and they discover it's not for everybody. And that's fine because right. There are a lot of other resources as well. So if you are a parent who is interested in this, you don't have to take one answer. You're the parent. You can find out what's best for your child. And in truth, that is why our current system fails, apart from, you know, the intellectual depravity of the system. A lot of the reasons it fails is it tries to create a one-size-fits-all solution for all students when, as we know, every child is different. As every person is different.
That brings up another political point I just thought about, is that I've been reading lately about how a lot of states are, or districts, school superintendents are getting rid of gifted programs because, you know, heaven forbid you have students that are excelling and you're going to challenge them. We want everyone to be the same. We want, you know, this sort of egalitarianism where everyone's mind is the same. So we can't have gifted programs anymore, or they've been called different things in different areas, because then those students, you know, stand out perhaps academically. And so it is so morally disgusting what's happening in education.
You have to, you know, this was inevitable. You know, once they completely gave themselves over to Marxism, there would have to be a day in which anyone considered gifted or above average would have to be branded as an oppressor and brought down to the level of the rest of the victims. So it couldn't have happened any other way.
There's the crab bucket syndrome.
Yep, exactly.
I know we've mentioned it before in case people don't know what that is. They say if you have a bucket full of crabs and one crab tries to climb out of the bucket, the other crabs will grab them and drag them back down.
So yeah, it's interesting that there are so many stories and metaphors that illustrate that same idea. You know, there's the nail that sticks out too much that it has to be hammered down. You know, there's every culture seems to have that. And most of the time it's supposed to be a warning, not an instruction manual.
That's right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So back to that idea about the schools being inherently in their DNA Marxist. So it had to be inevitable that gifted programs would be cut or eliminated, because you can't possibly have any class of people, regardless of what, you know, how you're distinguishing class, whether it's race or wealth, you can't have anything stand out. So, this would have to also lead to the discouragement of teachers who, and the best teachers who get the most enjoyment, or at least many teachers have great enjoyment from teaching those amazing students. And that would have to lead to them leaving as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw this during last year when schools went into lockdown. We were living in the Pacific Northwest, and there just popped up everywhere teachers walking away and going to teach in what was called pods. And it was where you would have several families pooling resources to pay a teacher to teach their kids instead of doing the virtual or, you know, all the stuff. You know, a couple of thoughts have come into my mind. First off, in Florida, schools that opted to have a mask mandate, the statewide superintendent offered vouchers for families who didn't want their kids to be masked in schools. So that, you know, there are, you know, some political things, and they're trying to do what they can. And so it is really a slippery slope in terms of the politics trying to help families. But really the best thing is just, you know, to walk away. Another thing is that meritocracy, and we were talking about, you know, the crab pot and the crabs being pulled down because, and the gifted programs going away, but there have been some articles and some educational theorists and people speaking loudly, and even in some areas, the teachers unions and teachers talking about how meritocracy is oppressive. It is a racist idea. And so the idea of ranking kids on merit is completely out the window. I know personally several different school districts in several different areas across the country that no longer give Fs, they give Es. And there are, you know, if you don't turn in an assignment, you get 50%. So the worst you can do is 50%. So you're starting at 50. So if you get half credit, then all of a sudden you've got a C, a 75, right? So the idea of meritocracy and achievement is really falling to the wayside throughout education. And one thing that the pandemic did is that it really just shined the light on this, where parents started to really see what was happening, and news organizations and, you know, particularly the conservative side of the news started to put this information out there. This is what's happening. And so there's this idea of everyone has to be equal, and it's an equal playing field. And if it's not equal, and if all students aren't getting these same grades, then it's white oppression, it's racist, and anything like that. And so this is really the think, you know, the sort of main ideology that's happening in schools also. So even if you have kids in public school, and I've also heard this is happening in private schools in some areas, and they're really highly achieving, they're not ever going to feel that satisfaction of getting that A, because think of it, it's like everything is curbed so far that the A student is only a point ahead of the failing student. And so why work hard? Why even bother challenging yourself to learn? And that's really the state of the education now.
The simplest solution is to walk away. If you think that you can reform this cesspool, then, well, I mean, I invite you to try. There's, you know, I feel, you know, when I see resistance take place at the school board meetings that we've seen, particularly over the last few months, and again, we're recording this in November of 2021, we're seeing outrage, legitimate outrage. We're seeing parents putting up some resistance to this. But consider also, as you try to pursue a political solution, how deep the rot goes. It's not something that is resolvable by simply replacing a few people at the school board meeting, because it is an assembly line of Marxist propagandists that have been grown in the labs that we call the teachers' colleges. Andy, did you want to say something? You look like you want to jump in here.
No. I go back to the point that I raised before that I think we could keep harping on. The history of schooling, when the rights of parents to educate their children were respected, shows how good education is when the parents are in charge. Andrew Coulson wrote a very good book, Market Education. And it goes all the way back to classical Greece, and it comes forward and gives a whole bunch of examples. And the reason that the education is better when parents are in charge of it than when any government is in charge of it should be fairly clear. One, parents love their kids much more than the government does. In overwhelming number of cases, there are some exceptions, but overwhelming number of cases. Two, they know their children much better than the government does and what the children need. And three, I think very important in this context, overwhelmingly parents have this peculiar idea that they want their kids to read and write effectively. They want their kids to know, you know, arithmetic at the very least, and then may go on further in mathematics. They want their kids to learn history. When parents are left in charge, when their right to educate their kids is respected and protected by the state, literacy levels and the educational levels are much higher. This is historically is the case in America and in any number of other places. So I think, you know, we could keep pointing this out to the parents. I saw on election night, you know, there was some woman in I don't remember what county, in Virginia, you know, and she was talking about we want to get rid of critical race theory and everything. And she was apologetic. She said, "We're not white supremacists. We're nice people," she said. You know, I felt like she was so bombarded with this leftist propaganda that white people are all racists and anybody who's opposed to CRT is a racist. That she felt, you know, she felt compelled to have to answer this stuff. Well, one thing we could do is point out to parents, overwhelmingly, you are better equipped to teach your children than the government schools are. And like I said, there's different ways to do it. Homeschooling, homeschool co-ops, where parents take turns teaching the kids, and the, you know, one father's an engineer and he teaches math, and you know, that's stereotypical, isn't it? One mother's an engineer, like Dagny Taggart and Atlas Shrugged, and she teaches, you know, the kids mathematics. And you know, I majored in English in college. I could teach, you know, the kids English, and you know, and so on. Homeschool co-ops.
These are not gender specific disciplines. Anyone can teach whatever they are expert in.
Exactly. And you know, I think Dr. D has mentioned this before. Homeschool co-ops are, you're growing, and they're a very good thing. And we could keep harping on the point, you know, like what they call micro schools or small community schools, but teachers, good teachers, as well as good parents, who none of whom are white supremacists. They just want the kids to learn reading, writing, arithmetic, history, academic subjects. They know phonics, systematic phonics is the means to teach read. Are willing to walk away from the system. I've seen, you know, a number of cases on the news and on Facebook, and parents can hire them to start a small community school. I think this is the wave of the future.
It's important to emphasize just once again that what we're advocating here, this walk away, this take control of your child's education, this is not unusual in the scope of history. And in fact, the what we think of as the traditional model of education, this age group divided classroom system, is something that this is what is the accident of history. This is what was designed from its outset. And if you haven't seen our episode on the origins of our modern school system, I'll put a link right here, possibly. and so you can watch that episode, but it was designed to take away individual initiative, creativity, and ambition, and turn children into automatons. So if we want to talk about a return to a traditional education system, what we're advocating right now, though it may seem revolutionary, is actually the more traditional approach.
Yeah, let me make one last point, because I know we're running out of time. As an example, about 8 years ago, my daughter was at Montessori school, and the schools, the Montessori school was already taking advantage of what we're talking about. So there was one kid in class, one of her classmates, mom was an MD and dad was a software engineer. And so, you know, mom would come in, to the school on some days and talk, about biology and human medicine, in terms that was right for, 11 or 12 year old kids to understand. And some days dad would come in and talk about, software development and engineering. And so some of these private schools are already taken, Montessori schools are, I think, generally pretty good. The real Montessori schools are already doing this, taking advantage of the parents' expertise. And this is what homeschool co-ops do as well.
But as with everything else, caveat emptor, with buyer beware. With Montessori schools, it's a brand, but you still have to do your due diligence. Mm-hmm. Not every Montessori school is created equal.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
All right. So, let's bring this episode to a close. I think our message here is pretty clear, right? Just be careful of political solutions, because that may not give you what you want. You beware of what you asked for, and really the best solution is to just exit the system. Any last words?
I think there may be some good intention behind some of this legislation that is trying to get passed. I know right now in Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, there's a lot of battlegrounds. The ACLU just filed a lawsuit against the banning of CRT. This is a very contentious thing right now in our country. And I don't necessarily think that politics is the way to go. I don't even know if that's the moral way to go. Personally, I don't think politics needs to be in education. I think it really does need to return to the family and to the parents, and for the parents making the decision of how their kids should be educated, whether that's private. And I don't think there should be public schools. I don't think there should be government schools, because the minute you tie government into anything, then you're handing over that to someone else. And that is wrong. And not to go down another rabbit hole as we're ending up here, but there are places where families don't have to feed their kids 2-3 meals a day anymore because of schools. So you don't even have to think about feeding your kids. And so this idea of that you're having kids, but then you're not dealing with them 5 days a week, 3 meals a day, all these hours, I think that parents really need to be empowered to really take back sort of this initiative of raising their kids and educating their kids and really understanding what that means and how important that is that they're a part of that.
Yeah, clearly if you have a state-run agency and it starts going off the rails or promoting ideals that go against your ideas or even the Constitution itself, that any political redress will be fought as an issue of free speech. So we can see how much of a slippery slope it is to try to agitate for political solutions rather than just to get the hell out.
My last words on this is I want to quote, you know, my good friend Melanie Hoffman, who's a homeschooling parent in Minnesota. She's not a teacher by training, but she homeschooled her three children very effectively. You know, she did the elementary school work with them, and then she hired tutors. And I'm one of the tutors that she hired, so I know how advanced, you know, her kids. So Melanie filled out a questionnaire for me for my book, and she kept saying, you know, through her answers to my questions to the parents, you can do it. You can do it. It's not that hard. And, by the way, in the well-trained mind, what's her name? Susan Weisbauer.
Yeah.
She keeps but reading is easy. She keeps reading is easy. It's true. Anybody who's got a healthy brain, any human being with a healthy brain, can learn how to read using the method of phonics, especially if the parents motivate them when young to show them that books are fun. You can do this. Yeah, I think definitely. And it can be onerous when you're working and everything, and or expensive to hire tutors. But I mean, these are our kids. Right? I mean, this certainly. We love them more than anything or anybody. So certainly for them, nothing done. For a loving parent, nothing done for your kids is a sacrifice.
That's a great way to end the episode, Andy. So thanks again for being on the show. Both doctors on our roundtable, Doctors Haakkinen and Bernstein.
Thanks, Joel.
Great to be here, as always,
Joel. Don't forget to check out our website, rationaleducator.com. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Parler, and Rumble. Thanks for watching this episode of the Rational Educator Podcast. We'll see you next time.